Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 7th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome two astronomers to the studio. Vox Pop favorite Bob Berman is joined by another favorite, Valerie Rabson of the Dudley Observatory in New York's Capital Region. If you have a question about the comets, the asteroids, constellations, Jupiter, the heavens, maybe a supernova, give us a call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can, of course, email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question, Bob Berman, Valerie Rabson, your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers here today to double your fun. We have Bob Berman, one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. His most recent book is Earth-Shattering. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rabson is chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Her dissertation focused on the chemical composition and structure of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. Hey, you got a question about astronomy? We got you covered today. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org with the number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rabson, Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yes, great to be here.
Big news. It's all over the place. Those of us who don't know much about anything know that the transit of Mercury is going to happen when?
Right. It's going to happen this coming Veterans Day, so Monday morning, 7:30 a.m. all the way till 1 p.m. You can see it the entire time.
But don't look at it.
Right, right. You definitely don't want to look directly at the sun. And in fact, you won't even be able to see it if you looked directly at the sun. You really need a telescope for this one.
You know, Bob, I always get a kick out of Bob. He tends to be unenthused about many things that I get enthusiastic about. You're not all that jazzed about this one.
Okay, because...
Oh, don't forget your headphones.
Because one of my jobs is to figure out, for the Old Farmer's Almanac and even for Astronomy Magazine, to figure out... is the public going to really resonate with this? Is this an event that the public's going to get excited about?
Yeah.
So in the case of Venus, we had Venus crossing the sun in June of 2004 and again in 2012. Now, that only happens once a century. You get a pair of Venus transits. You can see it just by looking at it if you block out the brightness of the sun. So you just need any kind of like eclipse-type filter. And there it is, a clear black dot crossing the sun's face. This one, though, you know, I don't want to sound negative, but it's only a quarter the size of Venus, and that's enough to make it just like Valerie just said. You need a telescope, and you don't need just any telescope. It has to be equipped with a solar filter, and not just any solar filter, because back in the old days, telescopes, cheap telescopes, sometimes came with what they called a sun filter. Don't use it. If you've got a telescope that's a few decades old and it's got something called a sun filter on it, a little one that you screw onto an eyepiece, no, because that lets the full brightness of the sun get magnified onto this. It becomes so hot that it can crack, and then there goes your eyesight because it takes less than a second.
Right.
So you need the kind of filter that's going to cover the entire aperture of the telescope before the light gets magnified.
Mm-hmm.
By the main or objective lens or mirror of the telescope. So relatively few people have them. Maybe you're one of them. Maybe you have a friend who has one and he's off on, after all, it's Veterans Day and you're off. The best time in that case, or you could call your local astronomy club, where I live down near Woodstock, the Mid-Hudson Astronomy Club usually sets up telescopes for this kind of thing at the College of New Paltz. But call your local astronomy club, or you could even go on, if you don't want to leave your seat, that you could go online to SLOO, because SLOOH has solar telescopes set up in the Canary Islands. They're going to be monitoring this whole thing. I'll even be on that one narrating
some
of it.
I'll tune into that.
Yeah, so it's slew.com, and you can watch the whole thing from the comfort of your seat. But if you got that kind of equipment, sure. Best time, as Valerie mentioned, is probably about 10:30. That's about the middle of it, and Mercury then will be the little dot that's closest to the center of the sun. That's Mercury, and as the hours go on, it'll change position rapidly, so that'll prove that it's not a sunspot, because a sunspot takes about 28 days to go around the sun's face. This will take a few hours, so you'll know that it's not a sunspot.
All right.
And I do want to mention, too, a lot of people have asking about those solar glasses, those eclipse glasses that we had a couple of years ago. You can definitely use those as long as you bought them a few years ago in 2017. You can still reuse them to look at the sun. But as Bob said, Mercury's just going to be too small. So don't expect to be able to use those glasses to see this.
Now, you were talking, Valerie, about the dwarf planet debate that is now raging.
Right.
And
I
guess I missed this one.
Yeah,
What's going on?
I mean, you know, we're still arguing about whether Pluto is a dwarf planet or not, but this new one is this asteroid. I think it's pronounced Hygieia.
Okay.
And it's an asteroid that's been in the asteroid belt for a long time. It's a couple hundred miles wide. And we just got some new images of it with the VLT, the Very Large Telescope. And it's a lot more spherical than we thought, which means it really should be in the dwarf planet category as opposed to just the asteroid category.
The mass is key to making it round. Bob, you and I have talked about this.
Yeah,
before.
Roberto Duran. We've said that.
No mass.
Yes, yes. Because if there's not enough mass, no mass. That's he kept complaining about that. Then you can't get a round shape. And one of the criteria, I believe, unless I'm wrong, because they changed it a few times for a real genuine dwarf planet as opposed to a piece of junk out there, would be that it's spheroidal. Now, Pluto passes that test, and we think so does Eris out there near Pluto, and I think Maki Maki might. Ceres, one of the asteroids, certainly does. And Vesta, the Valerie was telling me before the show, my favorite asteroid because it's the only one I've ever seen. You can see it naked eye every few years or so, very faintly.
Yeah.
So that's the key. Is it round? And this one is round. So let's let it in the club.
All right.
Exactly.
And now, where does this stand, Hygieia, as regard to mass with Pluto? In other words, is it bigger, smaller?
Oh, it's definitely far smaller than Pluto, for sure. So, you know, it really initially looked way more like an asteroid. It was just, we didn't know whether it was round or not, basically. So these new images show that it is. And there's also a lot of theories about whether or not it was, because it's part of a larger group of asteroids, and whether or not it's a chunk that came off of an original, much larger asteroid.
Mm.
But it looks like it's just a conglomeration of a whole bunch of small bits that pulled themselves into a sphere and made themselves a new dwarf planet.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's grab a call or two before we take a break, and we'll start out with Tim in Steventown. Tim, you're on.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I've been casually observing the altitude of the moon as it relates to the sun, and I know that their orbits, the orbit of the sun has the ecliptic is a 23.5 degree angle, and the moon also has a different altitude or a different angle, but in the winter it seems that the moon is higher. By my casual observance, I don't know how that could be if the ecliptic is lower in the lower on the horizon during the winter. I mean, where's the orbit of the moon in relation to the sun?
Okay, it's tilted 5 degrees in relationship to the sun's path, the ecliptic path. There's a 5 degree tilt, but the bigger factor, by far, the bigger factor that's going to determine where the moon is in the sky is whether the ecliptic itself is in the southern or the northernmost part of its path. Like some of the constellations it goes through can be darn low. The crescent moon these days, every month, the last few months when you've seen a waxing crescent moon, that is evening time, an hour after sunset, that's in Scorpius and Sagittarius. That's the southernmost, lowest, skimpiest part of the ecliptic path or the zodiacal path. But no, when you're talking about the full moon of winter, you're absolutely right. Then you're in the highest, most northerly part of the ecliptic, going through Taurus, Gemini, and Cancer, the crab. And that's why our wintertime full moons are high overhead. It can never get straight overhead from here, but high, high overhead, whereas the summertime full moons are very, very low. And that's maybe why they're often amber colored, because we're looking through more atmosphere. Maybe that's the origin of the term honeymoon. June used to be the traditional month for weddings, and that's when the full moon is most honey-colored.
Brilliant. Now, did you read that somewhere, or did you just come up with that?
I've been mentioning that for so many decades that I don't even know
where
it's
from. You probably did it on this show, too, huh?
Maybe.
Boy, yeah, I really should listen. Thanks for the call, Tim. By the way, we have a full moon coming up this month, and I was on space.com. This one is called the Beaver Moon. Do we know why?
First of all, it's not called the Beaver Moon.
Some people call it the
Depends
Beaver Moon.
Yes, some. Because here's the thing. Every Native American tribe had their own names for each month's moon.
Right.
And if you look it up, and I have a book on these because I want to know, the same month that, let's say, the Sioux called it the Beaver Moon, the Algonquin would have called it the Frost and the Teepee Moon, and the colonists, who usually followed the Algonquins, by the way, would have also called it the Frost and the Teepee. And then another tribe would have called it the Hoop and Stick Game Moon. And so there's at least a dozen different names per month per moon.
Well,
so,
on space.com, it says the Beaver Moon.
Yes, and that's why they are wrong. And your TV meteorologist who says, go out this Sunday and look for the Strawberry Moon. What they're doing is they're just arbitrarily, and I go through this with the Old Farmer's Almanac. I mean, I'm the astronomy editor. And some of the junior editors are saying, well, shouldn't we be talking about the Strawberry Moon? I'll say, yeah, sure, as long as we point out that it's the Strawberry Moon to this tribe and this tribe, but not to all of the other tribes. There's only two official moons during the year, full moons. Right. There's only two that everyone, including the astronomers around the world, acknowledge. Do you know what they are?
No, Bob.
Yes, you do. The Hunter's Moon and the Harvest Moon.
Okay. Why just those? Why?
Because those are the only full moons that have actual names. And all the rest are people just arbitrarily selecting one of the Native American tribes' names for that month and ignoring all the other tribes, but stating it like with certainty. This is the Beaver Moon. So you know.
All right. You know what? You pierce all of the fun sometimes. It's the Beaver Moon, right?
I have nothing against beavers.
Don't be a nattering nabob.
Actually,
Bob,
you know something?
What?
Have you ever had beavers around? They're terrible. They denude the area, and then the area floods. It's actually not good to have beavers.
Check, please. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. A few emails here, and then we'll jump back on the phones. Uh-oh. This one's from Harleen, and she's referencing the science forum from, well, I guess, last week. She says, at your last science program, the question of space-time came up. Please ask Bob to explain this. You have 30 seconds.
What puzzles people is that the word time actually has two very different meanings. In common usage, we mean it as a sequence of events. One event happens earlier than another one. We all know what that's meant by time. But the way Einstein used it, it's very, very, very different. It means a dimension, one of the dimensions of space, which is an amalgam with space. So he said space-time. And if you try to take each of those components apart, and just take the time aspect apart from the space aspect, it falls apart. And then time doesn't even exist in that sense. You need the space-time together to make it real. Otherwise, you run into all sorts of problems, some of which are actually interesting. Like, for example, if you had two batters, okay, that are hitting a ball.
Yeah.
One does a pop-up. Goes up high in the air, takes a long time, and then it comes down into, let's say, the second baseman's glove.
Okay.
Next person hits a line drive. It takes very little time to reach the same second baseman.
Yeah.
But because both of those balls started in the same place and ended in the same place, they have identical paths through space-time. But we, watching them from the stands, we'd say, no, one ball took a different high-up trajectory in space and took a different amount of time to get there. But through space-time, they both had identical paths.
All right. This one is from Michael in Rexford. When is solar cycle 25 going to get going?
We thought it had begun because the 24 reached a wimpy seeming conclusion of no sunspots. We had almost 2 months with not a single sunspot a couple of months ago. I haven't followed it since then, but that really seemed like how much emptier of sunspots can you get than zero? So that really seemed we're at the end. But until you see the first new spot with an opposite magnetic polarity from the old one, you can't declare 25 has begun. So if the caller had said, I just heard that cycle 25 began a week ago, I would have said, oh, yeah, I hadn't heard that. But yeah, that makes sense. Should begin any time now.
All right. And what's the plural of supernova?
Novae.
Yep.
How many supernovae have been observed by humans in the past millennium? And that's from Rick in Cooperstown.
Well, we could even name the dates. Can we?
Yeah, maybe some of them.
Do
I
we
know
have
a
to?
Few of them. Go the ahead. Early ones.
You name some, I'll name some.
Well, I know the earliest ones. The very first couple was like, 1006 and
right,
I think 1054.
Right. I love her.
Yeah,
she's exactly right. 1054. That was the famous one that gave us the Crab Nebula.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. That came from the 1054 one.
Oh, yeah.
But notice, that's two in a single lifetime, even though they're very, very rare. But in 1006 and 1054 in one lifetime, two supernova, and then half a century passed, and then there were two more in just one lifetime.
Oh.
We had 1572, was it, and 1604. Sure. One was called Tycho star. One was called Kepler star because of the astronomers that mostly wrote about it. Neither discovered either of them, but they each of them wrote about their supernova mostly. And so there is two supernovae in the same lifetime. And since then, you know what's happened?
What?
Nothing. We had a supernova in the nearest galaxy to us, the Large Magellanic Cloud, in 1987. I even brought a group of people down to the tropics to see it because you couldn't see it from here because you can't see the Large Magellanic Cloud from here. We went down there to see the first naked eye supernova in four centuries, and we actually saw it. Just gazing up in the sky and seeing a star blowing up with just the naked eye, no telescope.
Cool.
It was so exciting that it was worth traveling to the tropics to see. But that wasn't our own galaxy. That was another galaxy. I'm going on too far.
Gotcha.
Sorry.
All right.
But we usually see like 100 a year. I mean, statistically, that's what astronomers see in other galaxies. So we have tons and tons of observations of these things, but very rarely do they happen in our own galaxy.
That's right. Typically, the rate is, the last I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong,
sure.
Valerie, typically about one per century per galaxy.
Yes, you got it.
Well, now, if one was close enough to us in our galaxy, are we in any danger?
Yeah. It would fry us and give us cancer and change our genes so that we turn into other creatures really fast. Maybe that's why evolution sped up unevenly at different times in Earth's
fascinating.
History. But in the meantime, there are no stars that can do that. When you think of a supernova, you need either one of two things. You got to either have a white dwarf star in a double star system, or you've got to have a very massive star in its old age. Now, we've got that very massive star in Betelgeuse. But that's something like 500 light years away. They keep changing the distance on us, by the way, every few years.
Yeah.
It's about 500 light years away. So what's nearby? The nearest massive star is Sirius, the dog star, but that's only 2.4 times the mass of our sun. Not enough to go supernova. So where is the nearest star to go supernova? Not close enough to hurt us.
Oh, good. All right. We're okay for a little while. Claudia in Schenectady. Claudia, you're on.
This is probably not astronomy kind of question, but it's more of a atmospheric one.
All right.
I understand what causes wind, but what causes gusts? If you're at the beach, there are no tall buildings that would affect the wind. So what causes gusts?
You know, this drove people crazy for a long time. It was Torricelli, an Italian, who first figured out such a simple question. Why does the wind blow? And if a wind starts, why should it ever go from a 10-mile-per-hour breeze to a 50-mile-per-hour gale? Why?
Yeah.
And it was Torricelli who solved that about 350 years ago. And he said that the real reason for wind is changes of temperature, the fact that the sun is heating up some places more than others. And, of course, we have something called day and night. That'll do it, too. And different temperatures mean different air pressures. And so wind is going to try to get from one pressure to the other. Plus, we've got a spinning planet, and that has its own currents. That's why our prevailing winds here are generally from the west. Sometimes we'll get northwest, sometimes we'll get southwest. But that's what does it. As to why it should increase, there you get afternoon effects. You get shoreline effects. For example, winds are going to get going sideways. If it's heating up the land in the daytime, this is called a convection. And so the wind rises because the land is being heated. The air is being heated above the ground, and so the air goes up. But the air can't just go up because it'll create a vacuum. So air has to come in from sideways, and now you've got breezes, especially near the shoreline because the water is never heated as much as the land. So as the afternoon gets on, they increase in speed. So you got all sorts of things. Then if you got a valley aligned with the wind, that's going to funnel it, and you're going to you'll get more winds that way. And then you get a vertical effect too, because winds always get higher with altitude. So there's a lot of different effects that do that.
Well, thank you for that call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapsonat, Bob Berman, and Raphael in Stone Ridge. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a lot of curiosity about Jupiter, its mass, its gravitational pull on the rest of the solar system, and does it have a solid core? Was that ever established?
That's an excellent question. Yeah. So they're still working on studying the interior of Jupiter. I think the answer to whether or not it has a solid core is still somewhat up for debate, because once you get, you know, below the atmospheric surface, you know, you have material that's compressed to really high density and really high pressures, and a lot of times it's acting more like a liquid, like a superfluid, than actually a solid. Now, there's still potential that there's a metallic core way down in there, but it's very hard to tell because there's no solid surface to study. You know, with Earth and the other terrestrial planets, we measure quakes and things, and we try and understand what's happening on the inside with those, but with the gas giant planets, we can't do that.
What would your guess be, Valerie?
I mean, my guess would probably be no. I mean, there's definitely some metals there, but the temperatures and pressures are so high that they're probably just liquefied.
The liquefied metals are what causes the massive magnetic field?
Yeah, so you've got your metallic hydrogen there that can conduct electricity and generate those huge magnetic fields.
And to answer his other questions, the caller wanted the mass. It's 88 times more than Earth. And because of this huge size, you've got a spin rate. Now, remember, Jupiter is so large at 88,600 miles in diameter that with a 10-hour spin rate compared to ours, you have very interesting effect. Our spin speed at the equator, at our equator, is 1,038 miles an hour. Jupiter's is 25,000 miles an hour, way faster than the speed of sound. So with all of that happening, you've got layers that are rotating at different speeds. So they're rubbing against each other, and somehow it's producing this one storm that won't go away. And when I asked Carolyn Porco a few years ago, she's like one of the real experts on Jupiter. She was in charge of one of the Galileo instruments that was measuring things about Jupiter. And I said, so why is it red? Why is the red spot red? Thinking I'm the idiot who doesn't know the answer to this simple question. She said, well, I don't know. Nobody knows. And she guessed, well, could it be phosphine? Could it be, maybe it's a sulfur compound? She was saying the kind of guesses that I would do if I were put on the spot and had no idea. So what I'm just saying to the caller is still a lot of mysteries there.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Stuart in Stone Ridge. Stuart.
Yeah, hi. I was looking at an article that was an 89 article somebody referred me to, and it had to do with the interstellar plasma and the Voyager 1 and 2 having moved beyond the heliopause, beyond the heliosphere into interstellar space. And it described the plasma in interstellar space as being at 54,000 degrees Fahrenheit, but on average, it would be cold. I'm wondering about how you compute temperature, for one. When you refer to plasma temperatures, we think of deep space, even in the solar system, as being really cold.
It's misleading. It's misleading because by temperature, we just mean the speed at which atoms or molecules are moving. That's what temperature means. For example, if you go to the doctor, you could say, oh, doctor, I'm feeling terrible. I've got a fever. I'm 2 degrees warmer than normal. I've got 101. But you could also instead say to him, doctor, my atoms are moving 3 miles an hour faster than normal, and it's making me feel really horrible. Mm. And he'd say, okay, here, take some aspirin, and this will slow them down. Because that's all the temperature is. Temperature means the speed of atoms. So, but here's the thing. When you're talking about the plasma in space, you're so close to a vacuum, like around these parts here, you're talking about a couple of molecules per cubic centimeter. And when you're getting into the universe at large, you know what the average density of space is?
No.
5 atoms per cubic meter. Mm. So it's essentially a vacuum. So when you're talking about that, it doesn't matter how fast they move. Sure, at a certain speed, you could say, well, that corresponds to a temperature of 20,000 degrees. But in truth, when you're that sparse, when you have that much of a vacuum, you're not going to feel the temperature. It's not going to feel hot. It's not going to do anything bad to you. So it's a different kind of thing. It's not even correct, really, to use temperature because it's misleading.
Mm-hmm. All right, Stuart, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551, the number. It's Astronomy Today. Valerie Rapson of Dudley Observatory and Bob Berman, whose most recent book is Earth Shattering. And we go to Jay in Greenfield. Jay, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling to defend the beaver.
Good for you.
On two counts. You know, they perform a very important environmental function in the forest, creating new habitat.
Have you ever lived around beavers? Have you ever had beavers around?
Okay. Yes, I have.
All right.
Yes, there's a brook behind my house. There's a river next to my house. I live with bank beavers. I do live with beaver, but I want to make this point, that they serve an environmental purpose in the forest. That's one. The second is, a local person complained about the fact that the state did not allow the use of conibear traps in the trapping of beaver, and he referred to them as the offensive rodents. I've seen a time-lapse photograph of nuclear testing on the planet that would just appall you. And I thought, reading this guy's letter, who's the offensive rodent?
All right, well, we don't have time for the whole letter, but I do appreciate your defense.
Thank you for listening to me, Ray.
Yeah, that's okay, man. Thank you for not making any jokes. We appreciate that very much and your defense of the beaver. And let's go now to Stephen and Coxsackie. Stephen, you're on.
Good afternoon. How are you? I have another question about the heliosphere. I was reading about the transit of Voyager 2 out of the heliosphere, and there was a comment that it had been determined sometime previously that there was not a gradual drop-off in temperature, that there was a rather abrupt, which I'm assuming means measuring in thousands of miles at least, or kilometers, in temperature. Why would there be an abrupt drop? One would think that with dissipation of the solar wind, it would gradually drop off.
Well, because there's also a sideways motion. We never really understood it completely. We know there's a solar wind, thanks to Eugene Parker in the 1950s, who first postulated it. It was so logical what he said. He said, why do comets' tails always point away from the sun, like windsocks? This must be something from the sun that's blowing them outward. And in the tradition of science, the great tradition of science, we ridiculed him. For years, we said, yeah, right, sure, a wind from the sun. Yeah, right. But he was right. So the question is, what happens to it when we get 40 AUs from the sun, where Pluto is, or farther? Does that solar wind, which around here blows an average of 300-400 kilometers per second, what happens out there? How do the magnetic fields, the giant magnetic fields that are overarching in these things, does it make everything start to go sideways? Does it slow it down? And then what about incoming plasma? Just means broken bits of atoms. So what about these broken bits of atoms, protons and electrons, loose electrons from the rest of the universe? When they meet it, is there like a wall that suddenly one afternoon, 1 hour, you're passing from the solar wind to this incoming thing? Or is it slow? I know there's fits and starts and places where it's on again and off again. What is that area like? And how does it encompass 100 miles or 10,000 miles? And we didn't know. So these Voyagers are doing these marvelous things. And by the way, both of them are giving us different results somewhat as they're reaching the heliopause about what really happens at this interface between where the solar wind no longer is dominant against the incoming starlight pressure, if you want to think of it that way, from the rest of the galaxy.
Valerie, you want
to follow up to my question?
What'd you say, Stephen?
could I ask you a follow-up to my question?
Yeah, let's let Valerie do this.
We only have about 30 seconds here, but go ahead.
Yeah, so the second point was that the leading edge appears to be, quote, bullet-shaped rather than it being spherical. Is that, how the hell did they determine that?
Well, it probably has something to do with the way the solar wind comes out of the sun. I mean, the sun is emitting a wind in all directions, but it is stronger in different locations based on how the magnetic field works. So we also have measurements from both of the Voyager probes exiting a different location. So that probably plays together and gives us some sense of the shape.
So this is a polarity thing.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Stephen, we have to take a break here, but we'll be back. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Gearing up for the Beaver Moon with Bob and Valerie. We'll be back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Astronomy is the topic today. Valerie Rapson and Bob Bermanauer are our guests. And the number to call is 800-348-2551. Two emails here, and then we'll jump back for the home stretch. This one is from Mark. Quantum computing, if it exists, is supposed to be able to solve problems that fundamentally cannot be solved by supercomputers. What are some of the questions in astronomy that quantum computing may help us find the answers for?
Well, that's a tough one. I honestly don't know that much about quantum computing. Bob, do you know much about quantum
computing? Well, to make it simpler, without going into a discussion of quantum computing, what are some of the tough mathematical problems that a really supercomputer could handle?
Right. Well, I mean, instantly my brain thinks like Einstein's equations, right? And all of that complicated math to really describe the universe and to do these models of these large things, you know, stellar explosions, black holes. I think all of that could be, you know, helped with more advancements in computers.
Bob?
More computing is always good. I remember when I was last at Chile in Las Campanas at the Carnegie Institution, and Dan Kelson, who is... was just looking at this big image of a galaxy, and the edges of the galaxy were flying up into intergalactic space like they had ragged edges. So he was saying, why is it doing this? Is this like some sort of a demonstration of dark energy? Or is this, and then he wondered whether you're using the exotic to explain the esoteric here. You know, how desperate right. You're getting. So maybe with more computing power, you can make more sense of some of the things that currently are kind of marginal.
All right. This one is from Jules. Our buddy Jules writes, while we're thinking about relativity, how about a description of the light cone?
By light cone, we just mean usually what's meant is the areas that are beyond what we can see. In other words, that the speed of light allows for us to gain not just light, but information. And then if you're at a velocity faster than that or looking at a place that light hasn't had time to reach, you're outside of that cone. And so you're in a place that where no information can be gained. That's what's usually depicted
and,
by that.
And we call it a cone because, you know, light spreads out as you travel farther away. So really it's just that area inside of the light that you are able to see, very much like a flashlight. You know, if it's inside the beam of the flashlight, you can see it. If it's outside,
okay,
it's not.
Let's go back to the phones. And John, who apparently is in beautiful Easter Island. John, you're on.
Hey, Ray. I'm actually not on Easter Island at the moment. I guess I'm a neighbor of Bob's. We have a mutually departed friend, Jesse Reamer, from Saugerties, New York. But I just got in my car and heard Bob mention Maki Maki. And I don't know anything about that except that on Easter Island, the god of the Rapa Nui people is Maki Maki.
Well, that's not.
Did I hear you say?
Yes, that's not a coincidence because in the Kuiper Belt, the whole idea is that because so many new objects have been found in the Pluto area, that what to call them? For a while, they were called Plutonians and Plutons. And what about these objects that are very nearly Pluto's mass? Should we call them dwarf planets, Kuiper Belt objects? So it's not that much fun to just find labels for things in new categories. I mean, I remember years ago, someone decided that their order or their class or their phylum, I don't remember, but they wouldn't be rodents anymore. They'd be lagomorphs. So from that time on, in my youth, rabbits were lagomorphs, and they still are.
Good Lord. But who cares? We have rabbits, we have beavers. What show is this? What happened?
The point is they still hop around just like before. Who cares if they're lagomorphs rather than rodents? So it's the same thing here. We could call these things, now dwarf planets or Kuiper Belt objects or Plutons. But it's still just a classification system. Right. And one of the ones out there that are nearly the same mass as Pluto, we've got Eris, Sedna, Makemake.
Yeah.
And so these are just some of the, and there's thousands of
Kuiper
Belt
objects. You ever had Makemake? Delicious. Oh, a little mango sauce in it. Thank you.
That's a little different.
All right, John. So go ahead.
That certainly answers the question there, and I'll when I get back to the island, I'll tell all my friends that their god is up there in the sky as well.
I'll bet you get pretty nice dark skies there, don't you?
You absolutely, Bob. I actually spend a lot of time on a little island off of Easter Island, so if Easter Island isn't one of the most remote places in the world, there's just no light out there, so it's terrific. So next time you're in Chile, come over. When you get to the airport, just ask for John.
Start swimming.
And I'll take you around.
Okay, hey, John, thanks a lot for the call. He's writing it down, so I think he'll probably do that. Let's go to Tim in Ballston Spa. Tim, you're on.
Yes, let me get my phone out of here.
Great.
I had a question about the old Dudley Observatory, but when I moved to where I am, I had a beautiful flat-bottom valley with a wonderful assortment of trees, wildflowers, et cetera, et cetera. And when the beavers moved in, I loved it. I loved the aquatic atmosphere that they destroyed the valley, but so be it. Anyhow,
all right.
What is the status of the old telescope that was at the original Dudley Observatory on South Lake?
Right. So we actually still have both of the original telescopes. We have the Meridian telescope as well as the 12-inch refractor as well. So those are in storage right now. Unfortunately, it would cost a lot of money to put them back in a building where we could actually look through them. And our modern day reflectors are far better than those telescopes. So they do still exist. They're still around. They're just not fully assembled.
Now, wasn't there a fire?
There was. So both of the buildings are gone. I know at least
the telescope
second one
survived?
Burned down. Yeah, everything was removed. So the buildings were vacant when the fire actually happened.
So it was an insurance thing, was it?
Yeah, I see. Now I understand. No, we have everything from the original building still.
Okay, well, very good. Thanks a lot. Now, that's interesting. Can you put them on eBay?
Maybe. I mean, you got to pick it up, though. I'm not mailing it to you. The shipping costs?
Must pick up.
Gosh.
There you go. Bill in Gelderland. Bill.
Hi, good day. I've been tracking solstices since grammar school, and in grammar school we were told they were December 21st and June 21st, and it seems like the dates have changed over time. And when you listen to the weatherman saying what time sunrise and sunset is and the time of the day, it seems like the longest day and the shortest day are a few days after those solstices. Is that a misperception on my part?
No,
am I correct? And what's the reason for that?
You're absolutely correct. And you asked two different questions. One, yes, the dates of solstices and equinoxes migrate earlier and earlier as each century goes on. And this is all part of the big scheme of our 400-year calendar system. So the Gregorian calendar, that's the way it works, that to even out the fact that the number of days are not even into the year, they have to get earlier and earlier. And that's why many of us, I can speak for Ray and myself, we remember that the spring equinox used to be on March 21st.
Sure.
Now it's on March 20th every year.
Will it ever go back?
Next century.
Okay, good.
In our lifetimes.
Oh.
And it's even going to be on the 19th, a little later on this century. So, yeah, they migrate earlier and earlier. The other question about when shortest day or longest night and all the rest of it happens, it does not happen on the day of the solstice. You're right, because It actually happens in a reliable sequence. We're going to have the earliest sunset on December 7th this year.
Right.
That's coming up in just a few weeks, earliest sunset. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, we're going to have the shortest day and longest night. That's 2 weeks later on December 21st.
Right.
Then 2 weeks after that, we're going to have our latest sunrise. In other words, our darkest morning. That'll happen the first week of January.
Okay.
So they don't all happen on the day of the solstice. They happen separately. And to understand that, here's where you're going to have to bring in the analemma. And picture the analemma, that is the path of the sun during the year, where it's located at each date. And you'll see that where the sun, where the analemma intersects the rising point, the eastern horizon or the western horizon, the date at which it last hits the western horizon or the eastern horizon, that's the date that you'll get the earliest sunrise or latest sunset and all the rest, not the day of the solstice.
All right, let's go to Wayne in Catskill. Wayne, you're up.
Yes. Well, this is a question, sort of a humorous question, but okay. There is an answer. Has there ever been a musical comedy based on scientific theory of time?
Has there ever been a musical comedy based on the scientific theory of time?
Time, yeah, that's a lot of fun as we watch our beloved people get old and die and our beloved movie stars get all wrinkled and so that they can't get parts anymore. We're laughing all the way.
Bob, you ruined the fun. This guy has a joke.
I have an answer for you because I'm reading on page 100 of this month's Chronogram, the monthly, there is a musical called Jamot, Just a Matter of Time, premiering at the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill.
Oh, I'll be darned.
And it's based on the theory of time and the way we talk about time. It was written apparently by a PhD in English who also has a hobby of astrophysics.
So, wow.
Cool.
The answer is at least there's one.
Hey, there you go.
There's one coming up.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. And Jerry in Lenox. Jerry, you're up.
Hi there. Last time you guys were on, I thought I heard Valerie state that Mercury's rotation and revolution were the same period.
Pretty close,
so you always
yes.
have the same side of Mercury facing the sun. Mm-hmm. And my question is, if you moved Mercury to the end of the planets, would that change the rotation speed, or is that a factor of
right.
it being close to the sun?
So Mercury isn't completely tidally locked to the sun. It doesn't show the same face of the sun exactly, but it's pretty darn close. But if you moved it away to the edge there, then you would definitely see a change because you've got the gravity from the sun that is kind of tidally locking Mercury. And if you push it away to the edge of the solar system, the gravitational pulls change and you wouldn't see this effect. So Mercury will definitely change its rotation rate. For
in
sure.
other words, it is tidally locked, but it's locked in a 2-to-3 synchronicity. It's not 1-to-1 the mm-hmm. way, for example, our moon's rotation with revolution. The Mercury rotation period is 59 days. Its revolution period is 88 days. One is exactly 2/3 of the other. So, in other words, Mercury makes 3 rotations for every 2 times it orbits around the sun. So it is locked. It does have resonance with the sun.
But the further away from the sun it goes changes that.
Right, definitely. Yep.
Okay, Jerry, thank you very much. And now we go to Frank in Clifton Park. Frank.
Oh, finally. Great. Thank
Sorry.
You. I got a question about the Borisov interstellar comet that recently entered our solar system. And I was wondering,
yes.
will that comet be on a trajectory that'll help it close enough to the sun to create the tail? And if so, how much can we learn from observing the tail of the comet?
Right. So I recently saw some Hubble Space Telescope pictures of the comet, and it already has a visible tail, at least to that telescope. But it's in a hyperbolic orbit, so it's going to be going around the sun, and then it's going to leave the solar system. So we are only expecting to ever get one glimpse of this comet. And we've already learned quite a bit about its composition, and it seems to have similar materials and water that a lot of the comets do in our solar system.
So it's a little crazy that this year we've now had two. We never had one before this year, and now we have two interstellar visitors in the same year.
Are they coming from the same
Oumuamua,
place?
Oumuamua. How is it pronounced? Oumuamua.
I think Oumuamua. I think of a cow every time.
Right. Oumuamua. Thank you. That's great.
But are they coming from the same place?
No. They're coming from different parts of. They're all within the Milky Way. They're all Milky Way objects. But we've never had a interstellar object come and I could say orbit the sun. But as Valerie said,
whips such around things, and gets out.
They're always either hyperbolic or parabolic. They're not captured orbits. So two in 1 year.
All right, Frank. Thank you. And now quickly over to Ryan in Steventown. Ryan, you're up.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a hypothetical question about black holes.
Okay. And?
So black holes are formed when a massive object collapses under its own weight, right?
It doesn't have to be massive per se. It just has to be very dense at the end. You could start out just with 20 stars worth of weight, or you could start out with 9 billion suns, as in the case in the center of the galaxy M87. So big range of mass.
All right. Anyway.
Okay. So my question is, what if hypothetically a smaller object that wouldn't collapse by itself was forced by an external force into becoming a black hole, then if that force were removed, would that object still be a black hole, or would it expand out again?
Once a black hole, always a black hole.
right. You're never going to change back.
No.
Nope. I mean, you could theoretically take any mass and squish it down to make a black hole. It would just be a really small black hole. But yeah, there's no turning
back. You need
a
lot of force to do that.
Oh, right. Yeah, for sure.
And there's even hypothesized that miniature black holes could have been formed at the time of the Big Bang in the violence there, that we did have innumerable multi-sun black hole masses.
They're floating around out
that
there?
That are out there, yeah.
Oh, very interesting. This email came in from Wade. And Wade writes, since Bob likes to take the fun out of celestial orbs, can you have an astrologer on with him next time and they could discuss the differences of their fields of study?
Oh, boy.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun?
I still want to show up and sit and listen.
Well,
you'd
have to be here as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you have to be here as well. I'm sure you both follow the astrology, right? What's your sign?
Well, that depends, right? I mean, historically, I'm a Libra, but, you know, realistically, based on the year I was born, it's pushed back one. You know, there's a lot of drama.
Back
in
the old days in Woodstock, when we had Helen Weaver, still around, notable astronomer, and Alan Edmonds, who is the astronomy editor of the LaRousse Encyclopedia of Astrology.
Ah.
And we both had debates on TV and on radio. We had official, formal debates on the subject.
Was it fun? So, of course, back in the old days, astrology and astronomy were the same things, right?
But no, what I learned not to do ever when you said, what's your sign, is never tell an astrologer what your actual birth date is, because they'll make mischief with it. They'll say things like, when somebody asks me my sign, I'll always say, well, I'm a Gemini.
Yeah.
And the person will say, the astrologer will say, you know what? You say you don't believe in astrology, but don't you see how you're the perfect Gemini? Part of you believes in mystical things. Part of you believes in science.
Right.
You're conflicted. You're the person. And then I'll say, no, I'm just kidding. I'm actually an Aquarius.
You know, you hear that? That's the stop sign. We're done. Support comes from John Keel Music, welcoming the Dallas Brass to the College of St. Rose Sunday, November 10th. Lessons, masterclass, and concert. Open to elementary through high school brass students, johnkeelmusic.com for registration. Semi-professional broadcaster. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And personal wine cellar, Glenville, family-owned business since 2011, providing an array of red and white wines, spirits with weekly tastings, monthly scotch and bourbon tasting, home delivery services available, 518-399-9463. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. Appreciate the calls, even the ones about the beavers. I want to make that perfectly clear. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Jim Harrison answered the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Gail Sokol will be here for a Food Friday. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.